Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null. And I'll tell you so.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We have a lot to cover today, starting with the latest on health and healing and the role of gum disease in rheumatoid arthritis and how berries will boost the cervical cancer therapy, which is a good thing, and a lot more. I'm also going to follow up with yesterday. I had a caller at the end of the show in our talkback segment talking about artificial intelligence and that he worked in the artificial intelligence, military, industrial complex, so recently when he got out because he was fed up with their lack of ethics. And I said that today I'll give you some examples of why I'm very concerned that any technology will be used by the wrong people for the wrong reasons with terrible consequences, but they will not be held accountable. I'll give you specific examples, all historically accurate, of how often we use the full power and weight of the United States government to our advantage against democracies around the world. And Elizabeth McCormick will be here to talk about the questions that are important for you on our talkback segment. And I have an audio clip about three of the most common myths that we accept from history tying in with the larger theme that we're doing with today's program by a professor. We always begin with the latest on health and healing, and this is from the Arthritis Research Foundation in the United Kingdom. And they're talking about the millions, it's actually tens of millions of people who are unaware of the true dangers linked to gum disease, mainly because their condition has been undiagnosed or poorly treated by conventional dentistry. So if you suffer from chronic joint pain due to rheumatoid arthritis, this is particularly important for you. Why? Because rheumatoid arthritis, which is a chronic degenerative autoimmune disease in which the tissue that cushions the joints are attacked by the body's own immune system, and this eventually results in the destruction of cartilage and ligaments and bone around the joints. It's a very debilitating and painful condition. And although the cause of rheumatoid arthritis is supposedly unknown, this audience knows that I believe it's due to inflammatory processes in the body. Now, that doesn't mean that's just an inflammatory process in the joint itself. In fact, I remember visiting the person who I consider the best cancer doctor in world history. And he actually had the documentation to verify that. There was a separate, whole scholarly report done on over 50,000 of his patient records by Dr. Ardier of Leiden University, who found he had a 16.6% cure rate with terminal cancer in the United States, in Great Britain, France, Italy, Japan, China. The 5-year cure rate with terminal cancer is zero. So that means he had a 1,600% increase over anyone else. So when I went to Bavaria and I went into his clinic, which didn't look like a clinic, it didn't smell like a clinic, it was this old it was not a villa. It was more of a Bavarian lodge, and you could smell the wood, and it was very up, very positive, and nothing looked like a hospital or clinic in it. And that's where I first saw him doing his work in person, and he was leading a group of patients by taking their blood. He had all these assistants and nurses taking blood, and then asking him to close their eyes. And they were sitting outside about, I'm going to say, maybe a couple hundred feet elevation on this little plateau, cleared, overlooking Tegernsee Lake. And it was just a beautiful, in and of itself, just a beautiful scene. But then he turned on these loudspeakers playing the overture of 1812, and he led them in a guided visualization of how they were on this big horse, and they had armor on, and they had their swords drawn, and as they were riding into the Valley of Death, millions of these soldiers with swords also were on the ground, and they were going to pick up the speed, galloping closer and closer, raising the swords, and then start the attack, and they would he would lead them in this visualization while you're hearing the overture of 1812 just blaring. And it lasts about 12 minutes. And then he took their blood again. And then I spoke with him when he went down to his clinic, and he said, take a look. He said, this is their natural killer cell activity before, and this is it about 15 minutes later. It had tripled in its potency. So in effect, by simple guided visualization, he was able to stimulate the natural healing process. It was very impressive. And he did this on a daily basis. But he told me that he starts the therapy with cancer by first determining where in a person's body they have a local focal infection, because that is where your immune system is being drawn to. And he said the number one place in 95% of all patients where they have infections is their gums and teeth. So he had a whole dental theater there with dentists that would examine an x-ray and then remove diseased teeth. And he used ozone and other therapies to go in and clean up the gums. And only once the entire mouth was 100% healed, then he would look at other places in the body. And that included, do they have arthritis? And what was interesting, he said, your average oncologist never pays attention to the other diseases they have. They assume, well, the big disease is cancer, so we want to put all of our energy behind cancer treatment, and they can live with, you know, arthritis or something else. He suggests the opposite is true. So by removing the local focal infections, might have been in the gut, he did colonics and enemas to clean out the intestine. Then he would put people on a very clean alkalizing diet with lots of juices, lots of green juices. But then he would give them fermented foods, having people eat whole bowls of fermented product to reestablish healthy bacteria. Now, mind you, he was doing this 40 years ago, before anyone else had even known there was such thing as a biome in the, you know, the good bacteria in the gut. Well, here's what this is doing. This article from the Arthritis Research in United Kingdom, quote, gum disease is a threat to health in and of itself. Gum disease appears in two forms, gingivitis, an earlier milder manifestation of a periodontal condition, and gingivitis is caused by buildup of plaque, sticky deposits of bacteria that form on teeth and gums. And classic signs and symptoms of gingivitis include sore, swollen, or reddened gums, often with bleeding from the gums after brushing. Bad breath can also be a tip-off to the presence of gingivitis. Untreated gingivitis can progress to a periodontal advanced condition, a more serious form of gum disease that can cause bone loss, as well as loss of teeth. Signs of periodontal conditions include gum pulling away from the teeth, teeth appearing longer due to receding gums, and sensitivity to hot and cold, bad breath, looser tilting teeth, and gum abscesses. In addition to damaging bones and teeth, the bacteria and inflammation associated with periodontal conditions can cause heart disease, diabetes, respiratory conditions, and even cancer. By now, it should be abundantly clear, don't ignore the signs of gum disease, especially if you have arthritis. In fact, researchers have found that people with rheumatoid arthritis are much greater risk of developing gum disease, and after being diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, many people report that their gum disease worsens with more bleeding gums, receding gums, and tooth loss. So, that's one of the reasons when I'm counseling people and detoxing them, one of the very first things we do is we make sure that they've had a complete oral hygiene checkup, and because most people are sick, have bad breath, and they don't know what it's from, and we help them. And also, there's some things that can help. Coenzyme Q10 is certainly one of them that we should be using. Baking soda, an unrefined sea salt, can provide protection against gum disease when brushing the teeth. Using water picks with some with hydrogen peroxide, food-grade hydrogen peroxide, can also help clean out the deeper pockets. And then go to a holistic dentist who can, when do the proper exam, remove mercury fillings safely, and then use ozone in these tiny little the needles that are as small as acupuncture needles, and they can get up into the root canal and use the ozone, and that can kill off the bacteria. From the University of Missouri School of Medicine, they talk about approximately 12,000 women in the United States are diagnosed with cervical cancer each year, and one of the most common treatments for cervical cancer is radiation. I'm opposed to that. And while radiation therapy destroys some cancer cells, that it will, as does chemotherapy, it also destroys nearby healthy cells. And that is not good. So what is the answer? Well, how about blueberries? That's right, blueberries. Quote, radiation therapy uses, this is from the actual study, and it says, radiation therapy uses high-energy X-rays and other particles such as gamma rays to destroy cancer cells. This is an MD, PhD, a Dr. Fang, a professor at the University School of Medicine, lead author of the study. For some cancers, such as late-stage cervical cancer, radiation is a good treatment option. However, collateral damage to healthy cells always occurs. Based on previous research, we studied blueberry extract to verify it could be used as a radiosensitizer. And by the way, the radiosensitizers are non-toxic chemicals that make cancer cells more responsive to radiation therapy. And in a previous study, Fang and his research team showed that resveratrol, that's your very important compound found in red grapes, could be used as a radiosensitizer for treating prostate cancer, and blueberries also contain resveratrol. Quote, in addition to resveratrol, blueberries also contain flavonoids. And he said flavonoids are chemicals that may have antioxidants, anti-inflammatory, and antibacterial properties. Well, it's not may they have them. Yes, they absolutely positively do. And the researchers used human cervical cancer cell lines to mimic clinical treatment. The cell lines were divided into four groups, and then they treated each group and radiation by itself, and then radiation with blueberry extract. And, quote, our team used three different measures to confirm results of the study. Then radiation decreased cancer cells by approximately 20%. Interestingly, the cell group that received only blueberry extract had a 25% decrease in cancer. However, the biggest decline in cancer cells occurred when in the radiation and blueberry extract together, 70%. Okay, so let's get something straight here. They're saying that by itself, with no radiation, you're getting the same exact reduction in cancer, actually more, 25% with blueberries, than you got 20% with radiation. Then why use radiation ever by itself in that case on this in the cervical cancer when it's already been shown what will do just as good? It just seems, you know, that any reasonable and responsible person would understand that. The trouble is, in science, especially oncological science, you have neither reason nor common sense used. Also, they're not looking at all the other therapies that have used flavonoids, garlic, curcumin, castclaw on cancer. Imagine how much more improvement there'd be if they did a combination of other therapies instead of radiation. So, but again, I wanted to share that with you. And that was published in Pathology and Oncology. Also, from Duke University is a study published in the Journals of Gerontology, brand new just this week, and it's based upon analysis of a randomized trial that studied the effects of caloric restriction, meaning simply eating less calories. Now, you can have a big bowl of salad, one that would have all kinds of wonderful ingredients in it, and you'd be full. It'd be rich in fiber and the rainbow colors of yellows and purples and reds and browns. Those are filled with antioxidants and pigments, and those pigments help protect our body, especially the liver and the eyes and the brain. Or you can have a bowl, even not a big bowl, a moderate-sized bowl of potato chips or a moderate-sized bowl of pretzels or a moderate-sized bowl of french fries. you're going to have three times more calories. None of the nutrients in there are beneficial. In fact, it's actually the antithesis. It's destructive. But Americans don't pay attention to calories unless they're very health conscious. And you should, because there's one irrefutable statistic in all of science, and that is that caloric restriction with a healthy diet extends the lifespan. And that's why healthy vegans live longer than meat eaters. People who eat little meat live longer than those that eat a lot of meat. People who are stay at normal weight instead of being overweight live a longer life. So there's so many studies proving this. It's not controversial. This is not tobacco science. So restrict the calories and you slow down the measures of biological aging. Here's what it says, quote, this is from Duke University. The researchers determined that consuming fewer calories was associated with a slower increase in measures of biological aging and that weight loss was not responsible for the beneficial benefits observed. Well, that's a big one because that tells you dieting in and of itself doesn't mean diddly squat if you're not using the right nutrients. So they're saying here that when they restricted the calories, it was remarkable. Quote, remarkably, caloric restriction has been shown to be effective in delaying aging in multiple species, and the results in humans look equally promising. Indeed, for many studies, caloric restriction is used as the gold standard for enhanced longevity, against which new drugs and anti-aging strategies are measured. So, again, that was published in the Journals of Gerontology, so pay attention. Oh, and from Aarhus University in Denmark, something I've been suggesting, and I hope you have been paying attention to, that among the many side effects of chemotherapy, brain damage, including memory loss, and that can be the most disturbing result from treatment. In fact, new research is verifying this chemotherapy side effect in men who received this form of therapy for cancer. In the first study of its kind, researchers from Aarhus University in Denmark looked at men who had surgery for testicular cancer, and they received chemotherapy following surgery. And then another group got surgery but no chemotherapy. And the men who received the MRI scan at the beginning of the study, as well as at 6 months later, they also underwent a number of neurological and psychological tests related to memory and ability to concentrate. And the results were undeniable. After 6 months, those who received chemotherapy performed much worse on test. They show cognitive problems, memory loss, and impaired ability to concentrate. They also had difficulty managing everyday ordinary tasks, and the network capacity in their brains also decreased. The study results are published in the current Journal of National Cancer Institute. And the previous research has supported the higher likelihood of memory and cognitive issues following chemotherapy. In fact, it is so common among oncologists, they call it chemo brain. It's coined to describe this. And I remember Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, who was a professional friend. We would meet, we would discuss issues. We weren't personal friends, but I was always up on what he was doing. And he was a very vocal, outspoken person about this history of chemotherapy, and he spoke about it during his lifetime. But chemotherapy was originally derived from leftover poisonous nerve gas after World War II. And to make matters even worse, a wide range of natural protocols are being systematically ignored by Western medicine. Therapies like high-dose vitamin C, intravenous vitamin C, coenzyme Q10, vitamin D, turmeric, which is curcumin in high doses, even tropical seaweed. And unfortunately, all the money's in chemotherapy, and that's what people use, and they're not paying attention to the other things. And one final study from the University of Illinois, eating leafy greens, there's your kale and Swiss chard, there's your lettuces and arugula. And this is important because, according to the University of Illinois, the kale, the mustard greens, the collard greens can improve cognitive functioning at any age. That's very important. So what's the secret of the success? Scientists believe the compound lutein, L-U-T-E-I-N, and vitamin K are contributing strongly to this desirable effect. So eat your greens, have better brain power, better cognition. And there's another study at Rush University Medical Center that found evidence of the value of adding leafy green vegetables to your diet. The research results showed that regular consumption of these veggies can help preserve cognitive health and protect against many forms of dementia later in life. And cognitive function, as we know, is also assisted by getting plenty of omega-3 fatty acids and the antioxidants like vitamin D and C, which offer protective effects for the neuronal functioning of the brain. Yeah, simple. I'm Gary Null. We're going to take a break and come back, and we'll have on the line at that time Elizabeth McCormick sharing your questions that you've written in to her at PRN studio at gmail.com. Back in a moment. Nice to have you with us, everyone. Let's go over and say hello to Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Gary. Here's a question from Beth, who is a history teacher, retired. She says she listens as often as she can to your show, and she especially loves your historical anecdotes. Recently, you gave an insight into the true nature of Winston Churchill and how he was responsible for not surrendering to Hitler, as his entire war cabinet had demanded. But you didn't mention anything about Queen Elizabeth's father, George VI, taking over from his brother Edward. And she asks, do you have any interesting insights you could share that may not be found in your standard textbook?
Well, let me think. George VI was the brother of the person who would later be king, but only for about a year. And he was a quiet person. He was very shy, and he was a devoted husband. He was a good father. They called him Bertie, B-E-R-T-I-E. That was his nickname. And his brother was named David, and he would become king when he was 41 years old. And his name went from David to Edward VIII. And there are several things that happened. Most people, including most people in Great Britain, are not aware of. Let's back up a bit. Their father was George V. And he lived until 1936. That's when he died. And he became king, I believe, in 19... No, I'm referring to his father. He died before then. He came from a part of the British monarchy that believed in the right of kings. This goes way back to Louis II, who believed in the right of kings. And the right of kings meant that whatever the king wanted to do, that's what should be done. You know, you had the ability to do whatever you wanted to. And there was an enormous fire about that in the land. And people said, no, you do not have the right to do anything you want. And so they had a war. And it was a civil war, much like our civil war, except it was about the rights of the people versus the rights of the royalty. and the rights of the royalty were diminished substantially. In fact, there was a period of time where Cromwell, who had become the public protector, wanted no more kings. And of course, that would be overturned in time. And so for a period of time, they abolished all of this. It was abolished in 1649 during the English Civil War and by Cromwell. So you go forward, and here they didn't have the same rights. They have a constitutional monarchy based upon a republic. And the king is a figurehead. The queen is a figurehead, meaning they cannot make laws, they cannot suggest laws, and most importantly, they cannot engage in any form of government discussion on a private basis to cause a law to be passed. That is strictly forbidden. The two most powerful people in Great Britain, first would be the prime minister. Now, the prime minister may be liked or not liked, but then you have the foreign secretary, the head of the exchequer, which would be the head of our treasury, and the head of the Home Office, the people who handled everything domestically and people who handled everything in foreign affairs. The king was merely to be informed of this, and there were certain ritual meetings where you had to go in and you would bow, and then you would, or the woman would curtsy, and then you would back up, and you would give the king or queen, here's what we're going to do. Here's what Parliament is intending. Here's what our position is. And they really couldn't do a thing about it. They could just listen. And yet they had enormous influence over public opinion. For example, at one point, for about almost 20 years, one of the most popular and beloved figures in the world was the former Edward VIII or David. He was charming. He was athletic. He was a person that loved sports. He was a bachelor. And so people looked at him. In fact, we hear of the Windsor knot, when you tie your tie. That was named after him. So he would go to all these showings, meaning he would go to countries. He did more trips to more countries, including the territories of Great Britain at the time, which would be Australia and Canada and other countries, and the Bahamas, and he would show up, and everything was ceremonial. And you would always see him. He always had a slight smile, and everybody loved him. The women wanted to be with him. He was the cat's meow for a long time. And then he met up with, he was having a long time affair with a woman, a married woman, and he had all these affairs with married women. The question is, why would he have married women and have affairs with? Because he considered them very safe. Generally, these were women whose husbands had important positions, and they would not risk a social, or public scandal. So the women knew what they were getting into. They were going to have a fling, however long it lasted. It would be gossiped about. And there were different segments of society. You had the old royal family. And here's where you have to look back, go way back in time, and you have to look at people who were there at the beginning, like Queen Victoria, and way even before then, where these people wanted to keep everything in-house. Victoria had a lot of children. She had 9 children. And her children then were expected to marry first cousins. So everybody wanted to marry someone else in another country, in one of the Habsburgs, which is one of those powerful families, probably is more powerful than the English monarchy at the time, the Hungarian, German Empire, Nicholas II, the Romanovs in Russia, who had ruled for 300 years. And they were all cousins. In fact, if you were to take a look at Nicholas II of Russia and William VIII, they were virtually indistinguishable. They looked like twins, same height, same facial, because they were all hereditary related. In fact, Victoria and her progeny were everywhere. And what was of interest was that they believed that ultimately The public didn't know anything. They should control everything from behind the scenes. So there was always a manipulation behind the scenes to control the outcome, even if they were rendered somewhat limited by their parliament. And yet they would have great choice. And the prime minister, like Lloyd George, was famous for being very close to Victoria. In any case, he had an affair. And it was a really bad affair because it was with a woman who was not well known by anyone, but she was known in certain circles. She was a notorious fascist. Now, this is something you probably don't know, and this is not a part of English history. You won't find this in the textbook, but Wallis Simpson, she was married, divorced twice. She was still married to Simpson when she started an affair. And she started an affair because her friend was also having an affair with at that time, David, and later the king. When his father died, he then was next in line, and he became king. And this affair led the king to meeting people that under normal circumstances he probably wouldn't meet. You see, you had your old aristocracy. A lot of them had money and estates, but some of them had names but didn't have money. They were royals by title, but they were dirt poor. And it was against privilege at the time, and it was against everything to be constantly subsidizing these people. And so a lot of people who were wealthy might get some private assistance from the royal family, but it couldn't be public. It couldn't just because you had an uncle that had been around for 500 years, their family, and had a big estate, was the earl something, the duke of something, the prince of something. You couldn't just go say, well, we're going to pay off all your debt, we're going to pay for your gambling expenses, we're going to, you know, fix up your house. They didn't do that. That left open then all of these other wealthy business people from the mercantile class who would come in. They had no titles. They frequently were illiterate. They hadn't been to the best schools. By the way, nor had the royals. Though the royals are supposed to go to school, most of it was tutoring, and so they only knew really what the tutor gave them as insight. They were rarely seen studying on their own. But the royals also were not allowed to compete. So right now, anyone that you like, any one of the three male heirs, they cannot do anything in the workplace that would compete with a common person's job. They can't go open a business. They can do things on their own, like Prince Charles has been very environmentally conscious and promoting, you know, ecological systems and organic farming. But he can't go out there and compete with anyone else. That's considered forbidden because he is subsidized. The royals are given a certain amount of money to support their lifestyles and making sure they're out there for all the openings. They're purely figureheads, but very rich figureheads. And only powerful as far as perception goes. So here we had the business people coming in, and through Wallis Simpson, the king meets them. And that's not cool because many of them were not just successful at business, they were also fascist. At that time, the most popular and powerful leader in Europe in the 1930s was Adolf Hitler. And lo and behold, who was having an affair with the top foreign diplomat? And that was Wallis Simpson having it with the German top diplomat. And that was really dangerous because everything that was being discussed by the king and later after he abdicated and gave up the throne to his brother, all their information from the war cabinet, because he had friends. Remember, when you're the king, almost all the people heading the army, the navy, the Royal Navy, the admiralty, those are your friends. You've grown up with them. You've socialized with them. And as a result, you get in conversations. Wives talk. People talk. They have these social events that the average person is kept out of. The business clientele is kept out of. These are really just private circles for the royals. They have their own scandals, and they have their own likes and dislikes and intrigues, but that's where all the information is packed back and forth. So as information was given about what was going on to William VIII. Edward VIII, excuse me, he then passed it on to Simpson, who passed it on to the German top diplomat, who she was having an affair with. In fact, she would frequently disguise, and he would disguise, their letters by writing a date on it, and the date didn't represent the date, it represented how many times they'd had sex together. Like, you know, such and such, the 13th or 15th. And that was only found out later when the Queen's personal archives were opened to the scholars, not long ago, by the way, and at Windsor Castle, and that's when we found out. Now, think of this. Once they were out of power, they went to live in France, and he was made Major General. And Major General was really, he wasn't out there in active combat. They wanted to protect him. But there was a very famous battle back in 1916, the Battle of the Somme, massive British casualties. And some German bombers came over, and they dropped bombs, and they dropped them on a school and killed a lot of kids. And this just caused enormous repercussions in the media. So the public was outraged by anything German. Well, guess who was German? The entire royal family was German. They were all German. They all had come from German ancestry. They spoke fluent German, George V, though he was boring as can be, non-creative, not an intellectual, they were all related to Queen Victoria. And Victoria was the wife of the regent, and he was German. And he had been introduced by the head of the Netherlands, and that's what most people are not aware of. So you had German blood, royal lineage coming clear in. And that wasn't the beginning of it. I mean, the Hanovers ruled England in 1714, and they didn't speak any English. And George I spoke no English. He was German. And then you had George III, who had 15 children. He was the one that actually had a nutritional deficiency, but he was considered insane. Now, imagine you have 15 kids, and you're not a good parent, and they're out there with their mistresses, and you want an heir, and you don't have any heirs. And so there was a lot of intrigue that went on behind the scenes. And so finally, there was one that was deep in debt. There was a king who was in debt. He was ill-tempered. He was broke. He was a drunkard. He was a louse. He was morbidly obese. And he married, I think her name was Beatrice. And that would have been George IV, the Prince Regent. And so when that didn't work, Edward, the Duke of Kent, the fourth son of George III, married a German princess. And that German princess gave the world Victoria, Queen Victoria. So Victoria was German. That meant all of her children were German. And that meant before her there were Germans. And Victoria's uncle and widower, Princess Charlotte, all this was influenced by King Leopold of the Belgians. And King Leopold kept introducing Victoria to her first cousin, Albert of Saxe and Coburn and Gotha. And she was initially not interested, and Albert's mother, the Duchess Louise, had an affair, and Albert was only 5 years old, and the husband could have an affair, multiple affairs, nothing happened. The wife gets caught once, that's it, she's banished. And she was banished. She literally, the queen was banished, and had, instead of killing her, this wasn't Henry VIII any longer, they banished her, and she would dress up like a peasant and come into the local village And then she would walk up so to see if she could get glimpses of her kid still in royal residence. The former queen was dressed like a beggar just to be near Albert. So Albert was fully German. Victoria was born of a German mother. And so the whole house was German. And so what you had is you had on this day when all these bombs fell, and you had, I don't know the number, I didn't look at any news, I've never read that. I believe it was around 30-some kids, 20 or 30-some children were killed, and they did a whole funeral procession for these kids, and the public was outraged. So guess what happened? They changed the name of the royal family overnight, and the royal family were too dumb to do anything. These are not the brightest people in the world. The brighter people would have been those who were not of royal lineage but were at reduced aristocracy, and the reduced aristocracy were the ones who were surviving but not wealthy. So their sons and daughters were expected to become extremely educated. You might learn 5 or 6 languages. You'd learn Italian, possibly Latin, Spanish, Greek was considered important, French, absolutely. So that would be for an average person. You were supposed to learn all manners of court. You were supposed to study etiquette. You were also supposed to be accomplished in at least one and possibly more musical instruments, playing the piano, the violin. So you had an enormous amount of pressure to get your family out of debt. And to do that, you had to then get a royal who had money versus the aristocracy who did not but had title. And then you got that marriage, and suddenly then the whole family benefited, because it was common when a person was married who had all this etiquette and this manners and great education, they were just absolutely as they were terrific. Then you brought your family along with you, and now your family had all the benefits of that. So those were the people who were the ones who would frequently be invited into court, and those would be the people who actually were the personal secretaries, the people behind the scenes that no one ever saw or heard. Those were the real decision makers. And those are the ones who could make the decisions. And it was one of those that was the personal secretary of George V, who said after the bombing, and because the bombing actually used the name of the royal family in one of these bombs, and so needless to say, it was called the Gotha Bombers of June of 1917. And so it was decided we would have a new name. And so they did that. They changed it to Windsor, the House of Windsor. So any American today will think, oh, it's been 100 years they've been in power. That's also a lot longer than 100 years they've been in power. She's the longest reigning monarch in the world. But her name became very English, and it was named after a castle. And who did that? That was the king's private secretary. He did all this research to find out what would be a name that would be acceptable, and he came up with Windsor. And so overnight, it became the House of Windsor, and therefore it broke that association with them being a part of the British, or excuse me, the Germans. Now, that's something most people don't know. Separate is that the two best friends who were first cousins, Nicholas II, the last Tsar of Russia, and George V, the father of George VI, they would play together, they would socialize together, they traveled together, they were best friends. And then came the Russian Revolution, and then came the abdication, where Nicholas II was on a railroad train and abdicated and the throne, first time that had happened in Russian history, and gave it to his brother, Michael. Now, here's what people don't know, and here's some brand new information for you. When you have two best friends, and immediately all these heads of Europe, who are all related, Kaiser Wilhelm was first cousins with George V, and was first cousins with Nicholas II. They were all friends in family, even though their countries were frequently, in this case, at war. There was a period of time between the Russian Revolution, where the Bolsheviks took over, where Lenin returned to power, where came in back into the country, where Stalin began his move of consolidating power, where others, Trotsky was gaining, he was the intellectual brains of the Russian Revolution. There was at least 5 months where the Duma, which was the parliament of Russia by a man named Kerensky, they were willing to give Nicholas and his family safe passage to England. And in fact, there are letters now in the Royal Archive that have been released for the first time ever. No one has ever seen anything in the Queen's Library. And here it is. They're talking about King of England, King George V, is saying, I feel so terrible about, you know, what has happened to you. And by all means, you know, we're going to give you safe passage. And then his personal secretary, the same guy who said you got to change your name to the Windsors, and they did. And he's one of these very educated, bright people. He's not royal, but he's educated, and he is at the end of the aristocratic class. He knew everybody, and everybody came to him if you wanted to get a message to the king or a favor. Because even though the king had no official power, he could certainly make it possible for you to get a promotion, for you to get into a department, for you to head a delegation. So he had those backroom powers. And he said, you know, the people are very angry about this war. We've had massive death, including the Battle of the Somme, one of the worst disasters in World War history, and the British took an enormous beating. And the people are unhappy, and they're unhappy with the monarchy. So if you brought your cousin and his family, Alexandria, Alexia, and Tatiana, and Olga, and Anastasia, and Maria, back here, they could go after you. And so now, in something no one knows, he then gave direct, and he did not have the power to do this. This is one of those, he broke the rules. He told the Home Secretary, and he told his Prime Minister, tell him we cannot bring him back into the United Kingdom. And they didn't. And then shortly thereafter, they were arrested, taken to a Ketterenberg, and then allegedly shot. I have a different story that they weren't shot. They ultimately got out. And I spent 10 years of research proving that, along with some other scholars. But that's a separate story. But for the world, he caused the death of his own first cousin, his own. That shows you the kind of mindset. The monarchy, at the end of the day, will only be 100% loyal to itself and its own survival. That's not just monarchy, that's also body politic. That's all celebrity status. That's all, watch how quickly people run away from anyone who's in any controversy. Oh, we're not that close of friends. Oh, you know, I didn't know this, I didn't know that. Nonsense. See, what people don't realize, Elizabeth, is that at the court, you weren't allowed to take your views public. In fact, there was a prohibition that the royal family could never be photographed in any image that they didn't approve or that would show them in a negative way. So there was self-censorship of the press. You could get into serious trouble if you ever embarrassed them. So everyone at court knew that the former future king was having this affair with Wallis Simpson. And here was the problem. Had she not been married before, he could have married her. But because he was also the head of the Church of England, this ultra-Orthodox establishment, one divorce was considered a non-starter. Two divorces, no way. So he couldn't wiggle there to get that. And so there were people such as Balfour, who was the author of the Balfour. He was a special ambassador. And he told the Prime Minister, Lord George, what to do. And so before them, and that was about helping to get rid of the German name and to clean everything up. And the last thing the royal family wanted this time was a scandal. So he resigned and he went into exile, but the public didn't know he was in exile. They just thought he was in France fighting the good fight. Well, guess what? When the Germans, and they had already gone to meet Hitler, they spent a whole tour in Berlin. They had photographs, and Hitler laid out all the best accommodations for them, and he met Hitler, and Hitler made a comment about how charming the Duchess of Windsor was, and she was not allowed to be addressed as Royal Highness. They hated her. Everyone hated her. The Queen Mary hated her. Everyone despised Wallace because they all knew that she was a cold, calculating gold digger. She wasn't even attractive. But a lot of people don't know, but it's in the archives that he was impotent. He had all these lovers and couldn't get an erection. And evidently, whatever sexual fantasies had, Simpson engaged them, and he was able to have consummate his sexual relations with her. But she was introducing him in Germany to fascists. The places they stayed were fascist. They were all pro-Hitler. So then in private conversations, she was told by him where the where Germany was going to, you know, attack Great Britain, and there was a plane that crashed carrying information from Germany where they were going to crash, and British intelligence got a hold of this and said, "Oh, they're going to attack here." There were three places where they could attack. They're going to attack down by the seaside, and so someone in one of his and his friends told him, "Oh, by the way, there was a plane crash, and they're going to attack here." So he tells her, she tells Ribbentrop, the top foreign ambassador. He tells Hitler, and they change the place of the battle. And as a result, they invade to take back the old Rhineland that used to be part of Germany, that now, after the Versailles Treaty of 1917, became the property of France. So now they invade France. And they were not thwarted. It was a perfect battle. They absolutely overcame France and all of its defenses because the abdicated king and his wife were working against their own British citizens. It even got so bad that when they finally fled France, instead of going back to England where Churchill was demanding they come, instead they went to into southern part, I believe it was not Spain, but Portugal. And then finally from there, they were demanded that they go to, he would either be court-martialed. This no one knows. Edward VIII was told, you're either going to be court-martialed or you're going to go to the Bahamas. Now, the Bahamas was like 24 island, little territory of Great Britain, and there's where they went for 5 years, and he became governor. So he went from King of England to the governor of the little Bahamas, and all the while was pro-Hitler. In fact, even when he was in the Bahamas, they were still in communication with Russians and members of that whole motley crew who said, we need you to intervene to tell the English people that Hitler's a good person and that you should sue for peace. Now, how about this? Had he not abdicated, had Edward VIII, had he remained king, he would have immediately surrendered and sought peace so he could stay in the crown position and still stay sovereign, because Hitler had agreed that that's the deal he would make with him. So that's something you don't know. He was willing to work with Hitler. He was pro-Nazi. He was a fascist. And so was Wallace Simpson. So was their entire private, sordid group of people they hung with, that Euro trash. And so England would have stopped the war at Dunkirk. Germany would have won. And then there would have been no opposition because there had been no place for American troops to have landed to hit them back. So that's a secret no one knew. This was all because this man and Wallace and really low-life people. He wasn't like Edward the Confessor back in 1161, who had been made into a saint. No, he wasn't like that. He was a person in the United States that everybody was intrigued by him, and everybody wanted to have him at their parties. But go back to October 1937. There's the Duke visiting Hitler in Berlin. He died in 1972, and she died in 1986, and he was brought back and buried at Westminster, and then she was brought back. But at no time were they allowed. They were all persona non grata. They were excommunicated by the royal family, and no one would communicate. On the few occasions he did return and visit with his brother, his own mother wouldn't come to see him or even want to speak to him. And they had massive amounts of money. You ask yourself, how do you travel that way around the world? How do you have one of the biggest homes in all of France in the middle of Paris, like a four-story, beautiful, gigantic townhouse, and live as lavishly as they did? Because you got to understand, the royal family also is very wealthy, and he had all the money that he needed. So I hope that answers a few questions that otherwise you wouldn't have known.
That was fascinating. The loads of things I didn't know, and I'm English. But then that's not too surprising, because I don't know that much. But anyway, that was fascinating. Thank you.
All right. Okay. All the best.
Thank you.
Thank you all for listening. We're out of time. Have a nice day.